In the meantime, we're going to move on to book club, and we're talking non-fiction today. A new book that is sure to appeal to those audience members who are fans of true crime. It is the second volume of The Profiler Diaries, written by Dr. Gerard Labuschagne, who is the former head profiler of the SA Police Service, spent more than a decade as head of the police's investigative psychology section, and he worked on more than 100 serial murder cases, amongst many other crimes. You may recall the first volume of this book came out last year. Like its predecessor, this one takes a deeper look at some of the more memorable cases that Gerard works on and takes us behind the news headlines for a look at the perpetrators and what might have driven them to commit their horrifying acts. Gerard Labuschagne, welcome to Cape Talk. It's wonderful to have you with us today.
Hi, Seth. It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Just before we talk about the content of the book, won't you briefly tell us about your own background? I find it pretty inspiring to read your introduction to this book and see that somebody who almost failed matric ended up in such a senior position. How did it actually happen?
Yeah, I mean, I've always sort of looked back and then wonder myself. But I suppose, you know, school teaches everybody in the same way. And, you know, I think does that way of teaching match how your brain works? I think that's the one problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I suppose I just wasn't really interested in what I was learning at school. Mm-hmm. So I kind of thought I was smart, but I just wasn't seeing the outcome. And I just felt like school was always a struggle. I liked going to school. I liked the social side, but yeah, the academics always kind of escaped me. And I literally found that when I started at varsity and I was studying things that I was enjoying, I mean, I would sit on a Friday night and be reading my textbooks because it was really fascinating. And of course, that makes all the difference.
And that's where the fascination with psychology was given free rein, and on you went up to doctoral level with those studies. You worked in the field in a psychiatric hospital before you moved into the police service. Gerard, and it was during that time that you were working in the field that you met your predecessor, Mickey Pistorius, a name I think many of our listeners will recognize. How much of an influence was she in your decision to move into the criminal profiling sector?
Well, look, I think that like many people, I had an interest in sort of the world of crime, whether it's just out of a morbid fascination or professionally. But I knew there wasn't really many options in South Africa at that point in time specifically. So I'd always heard of Mickey Pistorius, and I thought, well, you know, if that job ever comes available, I'd definitely be applying for it. So I'd met her when I started to do my master's research, which was interviewing serial murderers in South African prisons, and I just went to sort of get her blessing. But we never worked, you know, so she left about a year before I joined. There was a gap of about a year or so in between. So, obviously it was someone that I knew, and over the years I would have contact with her, you know, just sort of almost friendly sort of, hello, how are you doing, and check-ins, etc. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, Gerard, to the book. The book covers a number of different memorable crimes, among them the murders of two young women in Knysna, which many of our listeners will remember, a serial killer who targeted sex workers. The one I want to focus on today, though, is the case of the Krugersdorp school sword attack, a crime that really shocked South Africa back in 2008 when a high school boy named Morne Haramsa took a samurai sword to school and executed one of his schoolmates. It was horrendous. I'm sure many of our listeners will remember it. The reason I've picked out this case from the book is not only because of how appalling and how gripping it was, but because of what you think it was actually intended to be. Gerard, you make the comment that this might have been a single murder with some additional injuries to a few other people, but that it was actually intended to be a mass killing spree. And you use the phrase that South Africa dodged its first major equivalent of a school shooting, for lack of a better phrase. I mean, take us back to what happened very briefly. Just remind us of what happened that day in 2008.
So essentially on that particular day, Morne went to school with his brother. He took a bag with him that had sort of two or three swords, a bunch of knives, some masks that kind of were similar to the band Slipknot that always wears these sort of quite scary masks. And went to school and donned all the gear that he brought with him and passed around a sword to one of his friends. And at one point he said, hey, guys, do you want to see something cool? And he killed the first victim who just happened to be walking by. And one of us remember, like you sort of alluded to, he killed one, but he was convicted of attempted murder of three, which means the court found that his intent was to kill those other three people. But that's sort of what most people understand about the story. But when you look into this, he had been telling people he was going to do this. Up until that Friday before, he'd actually planned with his schoolmates, the same crowd of people he was standing with when he actually engaged in the murder. You know, this one said he would bring a homemade bomb, and one did bring a fake bomb, thank goodness. And the other one said he would use one of Mornay's swords, and another one said he would bring a gun. So this was actually not just Mornay who was planning a mass murder. It was planned with a bunch of kids. Now, I think the other kids, you know, thought he was messing around. But definitely in Mornay's mind, he was going to commit mass murder, and the other people were going to join him in that process. But it had all the classic signs of these American school shootings where, when you start to go into it, there were lots of warning signs. Like I said, the Friday before was the last planning session.
Yeah.
And but he'd been telling people, I'm going to go to school and kill people. He'd been sending WhatsApps, and nobody did anything with this information, which is so typical of these American cases where afterwards we all hear about this information that was readily available pre-incident.
Yeah. Everybody says, oh, well, we knew there was something funny about that guy. Or the teachers say, oh, we knew that that kid was depressed. But nobody saw in that the potential for the violence that followed. You make the case in this book, Gerard, that it's a big oversight, and one which South African schools and other institutions really need to think about, that our ability to sort of assess future threats is very limited.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, the shocking thing is this changed absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
That school didn't bring in any kind of threat assessment, threat management program. Universities don't have such programs. One or two varsities have started to take an interest in understanding how to deal with what your typical workplace violence, which of course educational environments is a workplace, on how to pick up and assess and manage and identify these problems. So we see it like at universities, they'll have counseling centers. So there's a problematic student, we'll just send them off to the counselor and sort of that's it, done and dusted. That's not done and dusted, because psychologists aren't trained to assess and manage threats. It's a multidisciplinary approach. And that's not the solution, just to palm someone off to ICAS if it's working in a company, or saying they must go see a psychologist, or referring to your in-house counselors. That is not a threat assessment and threat management program. Mm-hmm. But that's what schools tend to have, or universities.
Gerard, I mean, you had the opportunity to interview Mornay many years later. He, if Alyssa's recall correctly, he pled guilty. He was sentenced to 20 years for the murder, plus additional years for the three attempted murder cases, and off he duly went to jail. You had the opportunity to meet him and interview him at the time that parole was on the table for the first time. What sort of a young man did you encounter?
So that was 2019. He had come up halfway through his sentence, so it was his first parole hearing. And I was asked by correctional services to do an independent review alongside with their own two internal psychologists. And I got to interview him. I got to meet the opportunity to meet his parents. And, of course, I'd known the case. I'd gone through the case file. I had the psychologist's reports from back in 2008 and spoke to the prosecutors. And actually the psychologists from correctional services view, there's absolutely no way you can release this man into society, that he's a huge danger to society. He has more concerning issues now than he had before he went into prison. And we were all vehemently against it. And that was the sort of ongoing position from the correctional services psychologist. But then on the 4th of March, correctional services decided to release him.
Yep.
So I guess they know better than the psychologist who assessed him.
It's really scary. I mean, my heart just sank when I got to that page and realized that, Gerard, because you'd written the story to the point where he was still in jail. And then out of the blue, the final lines of that chapter indicate, he was released into the custody of his parents in March of this year and is back in society. And you write in this book, you know, you elaborate on why you think he is not safe to be back in society. I mean, how do you feel as a professional expert who was called in to consult on the case, to have your view and the view that was shared by so many other professionals completely overlooked and overridden in this way? Does that not make a mockery of the entire system of getting expert opinion?
Yeah, look, I mean, personally, I wasn't surprised, because this is not the first time the correctional services has made stupid decisions when it comes to parole. If you will follow me on Twitter, it's my passion in life to post every time someone who's on parole has reoffended in a serious way again. And you have people who, they're out on bail, they commit the murder, they get sentenced, they get parole eventually a couple years later, and while they're out on parole, they commit another murder, and they get later. I mean, it's just this bizarre cycle of events where they don't seem to learn. So I was very disappointed, obviously, because I thought this is one case where it's so clearly obvious. He'd not functioned well in prison. He was always in trouble. There were substances involved, other pressures, gang activity. He kept on having his privileges revoked literally up until the time he was given parole. So I just sat there thinking, but how and what way can you explain that this is a good idea? Mm-hmm. You know, if he's been well behaved in prison, I can understand, I not agree with, but I can understand your argument. Well, he's been so well behaved, should we give him a chance? But that wasn't even the case here. So I think it's unfair on him, because we're setting him up for failure. And of course, it's just a danger to society, and it's unfair on his parents. And I just, you know, it just kind of really was deflating when I heard he was given.
and tragic for everybody who potentially crosses his path going forward. Before we run out of time, Gerard, there's one aspect I do want to just talk to here, and it's echoed in the question a listener has just sent me. What motivated him to do this? You make a very good point in this book that there is, in all of these such cases, the desire to have a clear explanation. We want to be told this person's been diagnosed with a particular mental illness, for example, or they were a victim of childhood abuse, or this is what happened to turn them into the offender that they became. Real life isn't that neat and tidy. How much of that sort of desire for an explanation is really symptomatic of our own inability or unwillingness to recognize that these are not necessarily monsters who commit crime, that they can be our loved ones, our children, our neighbours that do these things?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite understandable that people want an answer and explanations. I think it's very normal. That makes us perhaps feel a bit safer if we can tag it to something. But we just don't always have those answers. In Mornay's case, it was really superficially. He said he felt bullied and marginalized, which is very common, actually, amongst these school mass shooters and mass violence incidents at school. They often have this sense of, isolated from the community, bullied, over a long period of time, etc. So he was really echoing all the types of things we see in these overseas types of shooters. Now, whether that's enough to, a lot of people feel that. I mean, I was bullied at school, but I never ever thought of hurting someone. So there has to be something else, and that something else perhaps is the bit that we really don't understand.
But if you would like some perspective on what it might be, I'd recommend you get hold of a copy of the book. Gerard, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today, and it's a fascinating read. Thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Dr. Gerard Labuschagne, the author of The Profiler Diaries, Volume 2 has just hit the shelves. It is published by Penguin Random House, and you will find it in stores now at roughly 300 rand a copy. I understand Volume 1 is also still quite widely available. So if you are a bit of a true crime fundy or somebody with an interest in that kind of book, well worth looking for both volumes.